Welcome to the Meaningful Business Podcast with me, Jo Casey, the place for coaches, healers, consultants, and other service-based folks so you can learn how to build a sustainable, meaningful business without having to resort to the dark arts or sleazy marketing techniques. So I'm here with Andrea Owen. Hi, Andrea Owen.
I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you here as well, because so we've known each other for, oh, it feels like in internet years, it's like
always feel like dog years.
Yeah. So it's yeah. I don't know, it's like three or four years, and we've worked together before, and I can remember you starting this book. I can remember you being in the kind of the knee deep in this book.
A hell of it. Just say it. Hell of a giant creative project. You can tell the truth. Yeah.
And now you are launching your new book, which is so exciting. And it's so good.
Thank you. Here it is. Yay. I just have people watching on video.
Yeah. So it's called How to Stop Feeling Like Shit, which is just a genius title, because it's, so we have an ad over here for like DIY products like varnish and things like that. And their tagline is, does exactly what it says on the tin. And I feel like your book is one of those titles. It does exactly what it says on the cover. It will teach you how to stop feeling like shit.
Thank you. Thank you. That's a great marketing thing, by the way, the varnish people. Yeah. I actually came up with the title myself, and I was worried that my agent wouldn't like it. There's actually a reason that I titled it that, but when I told him that I wanted the title to be How to Stop Feeling Like Shit, he laughed out loud, and I wasn't sure if it was, and I asked him, I said, is that a laugh out loud like you like it, or that no publisher will ever accept it? But no, he really liked it.
Oh, that's cool. It's good. And I love the confetti thing on the cover and stuff as well, because it kind of
deliberate.
Yeah, it's a nice joke.
Because we wanted it to be, you know, for anyone who really cares a lot about font and design, we wanted, because the font was so masculine, which I wanted them to use, they wanted it to be more fun and playful, because that's how I am. And, you know, like, let's not take self-help so very seriously. Mm-hmm. So, confetti.
I like it a lot. So,
thank you.
Okay, so why write a book about how to not feel like shit? I mean, I know it's the kind of work that you do, but why this book? Why now? What was the driving force behind it?
It's a kind of interesting and serendipitous how the timing of it all came together, you know, because when I started writing it and I came up with the premise and the angle and the title, it was the beginning of, well, really, it was the end of 2015, to be honest with you. I started writing it beginning of 2016, so we hadn't had the U.S. election yet. You know, none of this had really, it was all just kind of starting. And then, obviously, you know, things have changed now. We're in the beginning of 2018, where this big movement is happening culturally with women, and I couldn't be more excited about it. But how that has to do with my book is sort of switching gears. I've been talking about these behaviors for a long time, you know, in my own experiences in life. And then I really started paying attention a few years ago to my clients and women in my classes. And I sent out a survey. Gosh, it's been a few years now. And because I was really starting to notice this handful of behaviors and habits that my clients were participating in. Mm-hmm. So the most common ones that I kept seeing were perfectionism, people pleasing, isolating and hiding out, numbing out, and control. So those five, I sent out a survey. I know, right? And I sent out a survey and I said, which one of these do you struggle with the most? And what the results that came back from my community were, there was no real clear winner. Most of the women said, I struggle with all of them. Mm-hmm. There wasn't like, oh, this is just the only one that I struggle with. There might have been like one that was really prevalent in their life that was, you know, that they were really conscious of. But for the most part, it was all of them. So that was interesting. And then when I would talk about these behaviors, I was really candid. And I would tell people, and still tell people, this is not about eradicating them from their life. This is not a book of, okay, here, Joe, here are the 14 things you're doing wrong. You need to change them in order to have a better life and be happier. This is about recognizing when you're doing them in your life so that you can choose something that is in better alignment with yourself. But when I would talk about these behaviors, I would tell my people, you know, these behaviors, many of them, not all of them, but many of them have got you to the success that you have today, especially the perfectionism, the overachieving, the control. Personally, that has gotten me to where I am today. That allowed me to graduate with honors from college. But we get to a point where they don't work anymore. There's a saying in the rooms of recovery that says it works until it doesn't. And that's who this book is for. The person who has done all these behaviors, and because it's all they know. And then they get to a point where they're like, this isn't working anymore. And it crosses the line and negatively affects their life and their relationships and their confidence. So that's who this book is for. And that's why I wrote it, because it's not working anymore. It's essentially making you feel like shit.
Mm. And so just point out for people who haven't yet read the book, you go through these 14 kind of behaviors that are not so helpful. And rather than, like you say, just say, you know, well, just stop doing them, because if only it was that easy. Mm-hmm. You give some real tangible, juicy, meaty kind of tools and practices and exercises to help to kind of turn it around and stop doing things differently. So how did you identify the 14? I mean, you said that you sent a survey out to your people. Did all of those come back from your people, or were some that you just kind of knew? Yeah, this is a bad thing. We only stopped.
That's a really good question. So for people that read this book, you probably notice that a lot of them overlap. Mm-hmm. I say like they're in the same family, and some of them are twin sisters. Mm-hmm. Like perfectionism and control. You know, if you're a perfectionist, mm-hmm. you probably really struggle with control, and vice versa. Mm-hmm. So, and overachieving too. That those really, it's like the trifecta of the triggered right there, and that's how they kind of branched out. And so I had this list of a handful, and I was like, oh, also self-sabotage. Oh, also the identity of being strong. Also imposter complex, you know, because that really overlaps with inner critic. Mm-hmm. So again, a lot of them are similar, but they definitely have their nuances. And I wanted to make sure I described all of these different ways of being and coping so that people really recognize when they're doing it in their life.
Mm. That's really interesting, because it's almost like this big dysfunctional family. Totally. Behaviors.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yes. Everyone's family, right?
Yes, absolutely. So obviously this past year or so has been intense in terms of, I think, a lot of the things coming to the fore for women. I think a lot of the things that were unspoken, I mean, like you say, we're at the beginning of 2018. We just had the Emmys. Oprah for president, please.
Was it the Golden Globes?
The Golden Globes. Yes.
Yeah, okay.
Oh, I'm so sorry. It's my Britishness. They're all the same. They all had dresses on. And they look
all the same. Yeah, exactly.
Me too. We've had the rise of Trump and populism. How do you see, that that's intensified what you saw was going on already, or is it just that's what's always been there, but women are now talking about this stuff some more? Because there's been a real kind of resurgence of people calling themselves feminists, mm-hmm. women being more outspoken about things.
That's a good question. And I think like the my first answer is I don't know, because I think that, you know, we tend to be in our own kind of echo chambers. I don't know if I've ever talked to you about this when you were on my podcast or not, but I am a former Republican.
You did.
My parents never really talked about politics, but my long-term first relationship, first marriage I was in, he and I met when I was 17. I was very impressionable, and they were conservatives, and I jumped on their bandwagon, mm-hmm. and I loved them. And so... It wasn't until I was about 30 and I had gone back to school to finish my bachelor's degree and took a class. I had to take a women's studies class for my degree, and it was called Men and Masculinity. I'll never forget it. It changed my life. And it was all about misogyny and patriarchy and feminism too. But I was like, I remember sitting in the class and just thinking, oh, this is the thing I've been pissed off about my whole life and didn't know it. Oh my God, I'm a Democrat. And it took me a minute to really realize like how much I was different from what I thought I was, but it was like head explosion. I thought there was something wrong with me because I was so angry about the way I was treated as a woman and culturally how we are fed this pile of bullshit. And I just would get all fired up about it and ragey, really, not just angry. I would rage. And finally I was like, oh my God, I'm not the only one. And I had such a false belief of what feminism was and who feminists were. So it was really good for me to have that. And so to answer your question, I think it's always been there, but I think that it's become, thank God, it's become more mainstream and people are starting to understand what it actually is, especially men. Because I mean, I don't blame men for being like, feminism is ugh, you know, and not wanting their partners to be feminists and not understanding it. So that's what makes me really happy in that it has become more mainstream. And I think that what this book has to do with that is I think that when women are engaging in all these behaviors, they're holding themselves back. They are not allowing themselves to fully speak their truth, to set boundaries, to just really just stand up for themselves and put themselves first sometimes, maybe not all the time, but sometimes. And I think it just allows women to, I know it's a really cliche term, but play a bigger game in their life so that they can feel proud of the women that they are and also be role models for the next generation. I know you and I have daughters that are the same age and I think about her and my son too. You know, I think about both of them a lot and what kind of person I want them to see and what kind of messages I want them to understand.
No, I know that's something that we've talked about a number of times. It's like, what's that legacy and what behaviors are we modeling for our sons and our daughters? You know, we both have a son and a daughter, and it's, and I think that kind of that level of doing your own work really helps what you're then able to model to other people, because, you know, that's how our kids learn. It's from what we do rather than necessarily what we say or tell them to do. So yeah. And I personally know a little bit about you, about your journey, but obviously some of our viewers and listeners might not. Would you mind just sharing just a little bit about your history? Because I have to say, I know you. We have known each other for a couple of years. I read the introduction and it floored me. I was into it. Not because it particularly contained information that I didn't know, but just because the emotional honesty and that being able to recognize that state of feeling lost. And you know, because you didn't come to this all kind of sunshine and rainbows and just kind of landed here just going, oh, I know
all this stuff.
Yeah. You learned this the hard way.
I did. Oh my God, I did. Yeah, it's been like 10 years in the making. And yeah, the introduction opens with, I will write a memoir that might be my next book, which is so scary. But I open with, and it's only just a couple of paragraphs where I really sum up my story just with commas, like this happened and this happened and this happened. But how it started was I to go even far, a little bit farther back, in my 20s, I was severely codependent and I was also a love addict. I didn't know what trust was or intimacy. My parents were lovely people. There was no abuse or anything like that. It just was not a very vulnerable, like we didn't have hard conversations. Things got swept under the rug. Like, if you just don't talk about it, then let's just pretend it doesn't exist type of family, which I'm sure a lot of people can relate to, especially being British.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. We've built a whole culture around that.
Yeah. You're welcome. But it's so funny, like, just a side note, we've been watching The Crown, and like, when their dad dies, when Elizabeth and Margaret's dad dies, and I'm like, aren't they going to hug?
Like, oh, God, no.
So funny. Anyway, so I got into a relationship. We were together for a very long time. We got married and we were about 2 years into our marriage, and we were planning on conceiving our first child, and he had an affair with our neighbor and got her pregnant, and the divorce and the split was dramatic and traumatic. I was very close at that time to his family. It was less painful for me to lose him because my intuition had told me all along, not even to not marry him. And I did anyway, because it was more painful for me to lose his family than it would be to lose him. He was one of five boys. I was close to them and their wives and long-term girlfriends. His parents were like, I loved them like they were my own parents. So to lose that community, and it's funny, my general practitioner and my therapist both said, Andrea, you have post-traumatic stress from that. Yeah. And I was like, there's no way. That's for people who've experienced way more hardship than me. But now I understand that that did something to my brain, like being pushed out of a family threw me into a depression, really. And it was high-functioning depression and anxiety. I didn't really know it, but I then quickly entered a relationship with someone who had told me he had cancer and it was awful and he was sick and then he was not sick and then he was sick. And fast forward 9 months after, traveling to Mexico many, 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 many times during our relationship, we lived in San Diego at the time, to get his cancer medication. Turns out he didn't have cancer. He had lied about that to cover up his opioid addiction, which is what we were really going down to Mexico for all those times, which I, by the way, was funding because he had quit his job. He had siphoned thousands of dollars for me. And at that point, when I finally found out that he was addicted to drugs, I didn't yet find out that he had lied about having cancer. I thought he still had cancer. I got pregnant. And I was faced with a choice. I actually confronted him about the drug problem and he admitted it. And then we went through like a week of back and forth, should we have this baby? Then he didn't want me to have the baby. Then the next day he did want me to have the baby. I was like, I can't do this anymore. So I called a member of his family and said, here's what's happening. I think he's using again. And she said, yeah, probably we know that this has been a problem for him. And I said, well, I think that he started using again because of his cancer diagnosis. And she said, oh, honey, he doesn't have cancer. And you're not the first girl he's lied to about this. And I had just taken a pregnancy test like 4 days earlier. And so I was like, okay. So, oh my God. And then just kept kind of getting worse. And she's like, get him up to Northern California. We'll do an intervention. Don't tell him that that's what we're doing. So I had to go and like pretend for a few days. Anyway, he went to rehab and we were going to try to work it out. I was hopeful that he would get sober and that we could figure it out. He met someone in rehab and fell in love with her and we broke up. And that was my rock bottom moment where I was like,
that'll do it.
How did I get here? Yeah. It's not like I was 19 years old. Mm-hmm. I was 31. I just was like, my divorce wasn't even final yet from my husband. Like we were still fighting over the dumbest things. His girlfriend had just given birth to her baby. There was still drama with that. I was pregnant. I was just like, I was so ashamed of where my life had ended up, but it was the first time I took responsibility for my life and what I had actively participated in, instead of wishing other people would act a certain way or change in order to make me happy. That was revolutionary for me. Because I had grown up thinking it's your job to make me happy. And why aren't you doing your job? And as soon as you do your job, this will all work out. I was terrified, but it gave me so much peace and freedom to actually try to change my own life. And I don't like using the word control, but really to take control. And I don't even say take back control because I don't ever think I had it in the first place, but to claim my life. And that's when it all started. I had to pick myself up off the ground, literally. I was on the phone with my sister, just like speaking in tongues. I just was just losing my mind. And I was like, okay, I am going to do this by myself. And I was terrified.
So how do you start doing that? How did you start that process of picking yourself back up, putting yourself back together, and then growing from there? Because
that's
some heavy shit you're dealing with.
I was done, because I had read some self-help books before that, but I liked the idea of change. I liked to change. I wanted to change in theory, really. Mm-hmm. Again, I wanted other people to change. And
like
I would
like change, like you're doing the movies, like they, you see them coming with the shopping bags and they've just come out the hair salon. That's it. They have new life. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. I have my self-help books where I would highlight excerpts and then in the margins write people's names of who I thought acted like that. Like, well, this is Joan, yeah, and that's Shelby. Like, these are my friends, you know? Certainly not me.
Yeah.
So there was moments where I realized that I did things. But when that happened, I was like, okay, this is about me and I need to change. So what it looked like was going back to therapy. I went to 12-step programs for my codependency and my love addiction. Mm-hmm. I read self-help books and actually participated in the workbook version, or, you know, journaling and really just journaling and talking about really just shining the light on it and taking ownership for the shit that I had done. And not from a place of, I'm such an awful human being, this is all my fault. Yes, there was like conscious knowledge that the men that I had been with were shits. But I had
chosen those shits. There was some level of, yeah.
Right.
Yeah. But he's
I had
my
tolerated
shit.
It. Yes. I had not listened to my intuition. My intuition told me. Mm-hmm. My intuition was like, oh, girl, if you just would have listened. But I'm grateful for having been going through that. I thanked my ex-husband in my first book in the acknowledgments. I said, thank you. You were the catalyst.
Yeah.
I do think that I was meant for bigger things. And the universe had been telling me and I wasn't listening. So the universe said, okay, bucket of cold water and a brick because you are not listening. Mm-hmm. Like, hence the beautiful woman across the street. So that's how I started. And just obviously it was, I think I did have a little bit of an advantage because I got into this work for a living. I use the term advantage loosely because trust me, there are some days where I'm faced with a hard situation and I'm like, I don't want to do the work. Can I just live on the surface level of my life?
Yeah. Can't we just do some affirmations around this and raise our vibration? And yeah. See, but I think that that's one of the realizations that going through the hard stuff gives you. You can't then pretend that, you know, slapping a smile and saying something positive is going to get you out of a really deep hole because, yeah, you know what it's like to be at the bottom of it and having to kind of crawl your way up. So I'm curious about what you said about your intuition had been telling you, but you hadn't been listening. So how, in looking back on it in hindsight, now, what was your intuition doing? How was it kind of manifesting?
I just would have a feeling that, I mean, this started when I was probably 19. You know, I had fun with my then boyfriend when I was 17, 18. And then I felt like I was outgrowing him. Mm-hmm. I did have some people tell me too, like, Andrea, I think you're a little bit too good for him. He was kind of a bad boy and just, you know, kind of every parent's worst nightmare. Like to get in fist fights and I thought it was cool. You know, it's cool when you're 16 or 17, but like when you're 19, 20, it's kind of like, time for us to grow up a little bit, you know, stealing beer and yeah. But, so it was that little voice of maybe I'm outgrowing this relationship. Maybe I'm ready for something a little bit more mature, and loving and, you know, trusting and things like that. And just ignored it. And again, like I was mentioning, I was close to his family at that point. My parents had just gotten divorced when I was 18. And so that had fallen apart. And it was just an easy segue into a new family. Mm. And then in my second relationship, on my first date with him, we met on Match.com and just had this witty banter back and forth. He was so funny and charming. I got conned basically is what happened. And I was so vulnerable coming out of that awful situation. He picked me. But on our first date, I remember sitting across from him at this really great trendy restaurant in downtown San Diego and thinking, there's something not right about this situation, but I'm not sure what it is. And then the next thought was, but he's so handsome. He looks like David Duchovny. Like, no. And I slept with him on the first date, you know, instead of mm-hmm. saying like, thanks, but no thanks. And then even I remember there was a moment in my car when things had gotten really bad with him. And I was by myself in my car at a red light. And I said out loud, what am I doing? And I wish that I could tell you, like, I went home right away and like broke up with him and it was done. That was definitely towards the end. But those were some big moments where it just was so loud and clear and I didn't listen anyway. I mean, Joe, honestly, I was at a place in my life where I would have rather have been in a terrible relationship than no relationship. I was terrified of being by myself. And I think a lot of it unconsciously had to do with the fact I didn't know who I was. And I didn't know if I could take care of myself, not from like a logistics practical standpoint. Yes, I could do laundry and feed myself and things like that. But it was like, I didn't know how to emotionally take care of myself at all. Mm-hmm. So I looked at someone else to do it for me. I had no coping skills at all. You know, our parents don't teach us this. Like, how do we learn how to do this? These were not conversations that my parents were having. Mm-hmm. They did the best they could. They did a really great job. It was just not something you did in the 70s and 80s was teach your children emotional resilience. No. You know? No. My mom's like, what? I was a product of that.
Yeah. Oh, I'm getting that kind of nauseous feeling as you're describing that, because I can so relate to that. That kind of somewhere inside you, you know what you're doing isn't the right thing, but we're so good at talking ourselves out of listening to that voice.
Masters of justifying our poor behavior.
Yeah.
It's the easy way. It's the easy way. Mm-hmm. And then I think for all of us, we have to get to a place where it's not the easy way anymore, where it's the way I describe it is like you tied a knot at the end of your rope and you're holding on and your palms are starting to sweat and you're like, I cannot do this anymore.
Yeah.
This feels like shit. And then it's time to do your own work.
Mm-hmm. So one of the other things that you described when you'd gone through this real traumatic few years with you know both of these men was that you felt so ashamed. And I know that shame plays a big part in your work. As if that makes it sound like, do you know what I mean? So you I will edit
you're shame
that
for human being.
Yeah. So you have done work with Dr. Brené Brown and done her program, which is all around shame resilience and how shame plays out in our culture and our behavior. And so what do you now know about how shame operates, about those kind of feelings, those very real feelings that we get and the moments in our lives when we kind of go, I'm so ashamed. It's like the world's most excruciating sensation. I would rather do anything than feel like this.
Completely. And I think you described it so well. And that's a great segue for me to answer the question, because, you know, we could talk about shame all day long. And I specifically want to talk about it and how it plays out in the women that I work with and probably the women that you work with, because I think it can have its nuances and get specific. Because what I kept hearing over and over again with the women who, and for people who are listening who don't know, Brené Brown is a researcher and author who's extensively studied shame in her in her professional life. And they, you know, my community says, I don't walk around feeling ashamed, you know, like, and even some of my private clients have said, I can't recall experiences specifically where I have felt immense shame. Mm-hmm. I get that sometimes too. They might have like one middle school experience or, you know, like if they were heavy, you know, like a fat shaming experience or something like that, somebody made fun of them. But here's how I describe it. Anytime, and Brené has talked about this too, anytime you're engaging in, especially the behaviors of perfectionism, of overachieving, of people pleasing, just to name a few, you are, even if the identity of being strong, you are actively avoiding shame. Because by doing those behaviors, you are trying to engineer your life to look a certain way, to avoid failure and criticism and judgment, which is shame. So it might not be that you're actively feeling shame and trying to dodge it, but it's that you are trying to avoid it completely. Because like you said, we all deep down, like even if you can't recall a specific event, you know what that feels like. And like you said, it's the most excruciating thing ever. I like that Brené calls it, it's a full contact emotion. We have a physiological reaction to shame.
And I wonder if that's why some of your clients can't actually, because it's almost like it bypasses the cognitive. It is like a physical sensation. So it's just like, well, I can't recall actually feeling shame because it's not an up here emotion.
Right. It's deep down.
Yeah.
And it's just that feeling of like that you are not like the others, that, you know, and I have in the private work that I do, one of the, we do some creative exercises. I ask people to draw it. What does it look like for you? The majority of what people draw is some version of feeling alone. Like I'll have like one client who drew like a stick figure in a corner, and then there's a group of people outside, you know, like with their backs turned to her. Or like a feeling, you know, a stick figure with like black energy around it with people all around. So it's that feeling that you are not like the others, that you have been rejected. And this goes back to like our old lizard brain, to feel shame, to be rejected from a tribe. And this is why I think that my experience was so traumatic for me.
Yeah.
That meant death. Like you probably wouldn't live if you were alone.
Mm-hmm.
So no wonder, you know, we are, our lives are different now, but our brains haven't evolved. Like, no wonder we are actively doing everything possible to avoid that feeling.
Yeah.
You know, hence perfectionism, people pleasing, you know, we don't want to rock the boat. We want to be perceived a certain way,
mm-hmm.
you know, enter all of these behaviors.
Mm-hmm.
And again, like, I just want to say one more thing about that. This isn't about like stopping them completely. Like I want the win to be for people that they recognize when they're doing it so that they can be aware of it mm-hmm. and choose behaviors that feel better to them.
Yeah. I mean, like you say, some of these have can be really useful sometimes.
Mm-hmm.
Like having a certain level of control in your life means, you know, you're able to pay your bills on time and,
yeah.
you know, get your kids to school on time and, you know,
I make my bed every day. Like to me, that feels like I have some semblance of control of my life.
Yeah.
Yes. And again, it's not about completely having the pendulum swing the other way, which I have a lot of people who tend to be dichotomous thinkers and think that that's what they need to do. It's not about that. It's just knowing when it negatively affects your life.
Yeah. Yeah. My besties, we describe ourselves as we're tightly wound women. And sometimes that can be really helpful, like when we need to get somewhere on time or
mm-hmm.
but yeah, and sometimes it's just crazy making for everyone in our world.
Just the shrapnel everywhere. Yeah, when it goes awry.
Yeah.
Exactly. And again, like I don't want anyone to change their personality. I talk about values in the book, the very last chapter, and most of my community and probably yours too, they have a value around excellence. If you're going to do something, mm-hmm. do it well.
Yeah.
They probably have a value around efficiency. So that's control. Like, yes, keep doing those things. But like, when is it actually stopping you from playing a bigger game? When is it actually stopping you from speaking out and honoring the person that you really want to be?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, we're getting close to the end of our time together. I'm not going to ask you to go through all 14 of them, but just kind of give people the gist of what are the types of things that we're talking about and the types of change that they can see. I mean, hopefully that they stop feeling like shit.
Yeah.
Let
me read a few of them that I think that your audience might really struggle with.
Mm-hmm.
So chapter 2, go away and leave me alone. Isolating and hiding out isn't protecting you.
That was
checking
the one
out
that was like a stomach punch to me. I was like, oh, don't make me. You know, it's like when you're in a great coaching session, when you're being coached and it's almost like they just pin you in the place where you're like, don't make me look at this thing.
I always like slowly close my laptop. Oh my God.
That was the chapter that got me. Don't make me share my vulnerabilities with other people.
Isolating and hiding out isn't protecting you. Yeah. Chapter 3, checking out, are your numbing mechanisms still working for you? Let's see. Imposter complex. I've talked about the other ones. Being strong, the elusive tough exterior. That's one of my favorites. But I think that I forget what your initial question was.
I just wanted you to give people a bit more of a flavor of the type of things that, the type of behaviors that you're talking about, but also, so what's on the other side of this? Not that, you know, you read the book and then tomorrow morning, you're going to feel just bright-eyed, bushy-tailed, and you will have no more issues.
You'll just have information. Like, I don't. The work. I'm not going to pretend that you don't. But, God, wouldn't it be great if $11.79 would totally change our lives?
But, I mean, joking aside, I think what they do have then is a really serious toolkit.
Yeah. And there's lots of tools, but two of the main biggest tools that I talk about that are kind of over and over again throughout the chapters is values, which I already mentioned. That is about, I care less about what the names of your values are. I want to know exactly what they look like. Mm-hmm. When you are leaning way into perfectionism, when you are micromanaging and leaning way into control, how is that, like, what are you actually trying to do? And if you look at your values, what do those values actually look like? And how can you be proud of the person that you are? So an example of that, if you are a huge perfectionist and control person, is that you are unattached to the outcome. Like, you can still do your absolute best and surrender to whatever might happen. Mm-hmm. And your intention is successful to you, not your reception. So that's just one example of holding close to your values and not leaning too far into perfectionism and control. Mm-hmm. And then the other thing is sharing your stuff with a compassionate witness. I know Brené Brown says, sharing the right story with the right person at the right time. Someone who's earned the right to hear it. And I think, you know, it's one of the very first things that we work on when I work with someone privately, mm-hmm. is I want to know who your key players are and what does that relationship look like? And what are you doing to nurture it? Because I have a lot of women that come to me who have, like, kicked ass in their careers and their interpersonal relationships are not that great. And they just haven't made it a priority. Mm-hmm. Especially like when you get out of high school and college and you don't have that built-in thing anymore, or when our kids get a little bit older, yeah. and they're not the mommy
group. Work from home and this is your world. Yeah.
And it's just your dog.
Yeah.
So and I'm not talking about just like coffee dates and shooting the shit. I'm talking about like when you have a massive problem with your partner, mm-hmm. or you have a launch that went terribly, or, you know, or your child gets sick or you lose a parent. Like, when the really hard stuff happens, are you saying, I don't want to reach out to Joe because I know she's really busy right now, or I don't want to share my story. You're just embarrassed or ashamed of where you ended up. Mm-hmm. That is what I want to talk to you about. It's about, you know, I really challenge my clients. And, you know, for instance, I have one client who has a dear friend, and I said, when was the last time you told her how much she means to you? And how this is, you know, it's trust building.
I don't know if you can see on my face, but this whole thing is making me kind of go.
Wait for it, you're going to love this. And she's like, oh, and she's Canadian, which is like, I know Canadians are kind of similar with the Brits as far as like politeness and things like that. So she's like, oh, I write cards to her for holidays and her birthday. And I'm always, you know, just gush about how much she means to me. And I was like, that's amazing. I want you to do it in person. I want you to say those words. Exactly. That is her face. She was like, well. and here's the thing is, as I told her, I said, I want this to come out of your throat chakra. Like, it's a challenge. And, you know, the thing is like, that friend is, that's a sure thing, you know, like, you know, that person's going to appreciate it and probably be uncomfortable, but it's not like it's a huge risk where this person might be like, oh, I don't feel the same way. But it's those kinds of exercises that I want you to practice of nurturing these female friendships that are so important to us. Like, culturally, we have come so far away from that. There is research that shows like we thrive in villages and communities where we have these close relationships. And that's what I want. And you don't have to have 10 of these friends. It's, you know, one or two. Just work on it and make it a priority. And this is not easy. Like, trust me, I am someone who, like, talk about trust issues. I was like, you stay over there.
Everyone stick to the corners, please.
We'll be just.
Yeah, my emotional bandwidth is this big.
Right. Yeah, I was good at emotional boundaries. But it's been a lot of work for me, too, in trusting other females and letting them love me. I didn't want to do that. And it's been hard work for me, too. I have to practice what I preach. Mm. And it can change your life.
Thank you so much. This has been such a rich and thought-provoking conversation for me. Because it's all about me. I really hope that for those of you watching or listening have also found this useful. Go and buy the book. Honestly, I read a lot of personal development books because it's kind of my job. But this one, not only on a professional level did I go, huh, yeah, there's some solid stuff in there. You know, there's really good useful exercises where you will see change. But also, there were times when it had me in tears. There were times it had me laughing out loud. Honestly, it's a lovely, lovely book. So please go out and buy it. And I wouldn't, you know, I wouldn't say that if I didn't mean it.
You're like, it's okay.
Yeah, here's the book, and we'll put it in the show notes. And we'll say as little as possible about it.
No, seriously, go buy it. Yeah, thank you.
Thank you for spending the time today, and it was so nice getting to hang out with you again.
Always, I'm looking for an excuse to talk to you, so it was my pleasure.
Well, I'm honored. Thank you so much. I'll speak to you soon. Bye bye. So as we wrapped up our conversation, Andrea told me that she's actually running a free book club, like a book study group, where she's going to be leading people live week by week over 4 weeks, starting on the 22nd of January, 2018. Through some of the concepts in the book, and that is a special offer for people who have bought the book. So I will include all of the details of how you sign up for that in the show notes. Thank you so much for listening, and I will speak to you very soon. Thanks for listening to the Meaningful Business Podcast with me, Jo Casey. If you want to know more about how you can grow your meaningful business, then head over to meaningfulbizacademy.com. That's meaningfulbizacademy.com. Here you'll find all of the details of the academy, including masterclasses, courses, co-working opportunities, member discounts, how you can get free coaching, exclusive meditations to help build your confidence and bust through those mindset blocks, and a whole lot more. That's meaningfulbizacademy.com, and I'll speak to you soon.